A Biblical Theory of Sexuality, Part 2, a talk in the series Issues in a Biblical Worldview, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 14, 1992, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Okay, I think what I would like to do to start with is look at a passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and we'll look briefly at another one in 1 Thessalonians. I want to start there and then kind of summarize and get back to some more systematic presentation after that. 1 Corinthians 6, 12 through 20. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. Food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food, but God will do away with both of them. Yet the body is not for immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. Now God has not only raised the Lord, but will also raise us up through his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take away the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? May it never be. Or do you not know that the one who joins himself to a harlot is one body with her? For he says, the two will become one flesh. But the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee immorality. For every other sin that a man commits is outside the body. Literally, it's every sin that a man commits is outside the body. But the immoral man sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own? For you have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. Now, this is, on the first reading, a very bizarre and strange passage. On the second reading, it's not quite as bizarre, but it's still very difficult. This is not an easy passage. And I don't claim to know that I have all the problems solved, and therefore that I'm really actually ultimately on the right track here. But I think I have a handle on the passage better than I ever have any other time in my life, so I think I'm prepared to try to teach it. He starts off, all things are lawful for me, and I think what he's doing is the certain people in Corinth, I think, have taken some of the teaching of Paul and are using it, actually distorting it and perverting what it is that Paul is saying. And they have probably taken it as some kind of slogan, all things are lawful for me. And they are using that, all things are lawful for me, to justify some of their teaching. And in fact, probably what they're justifying with it is sexual immorality, because all things are lawful for me. I'm no longer under the law. I'm saved by grace. I'm saved by faith. All things are clean now. Sex is just a natural, normal human experience and encounter. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing evil about it. So get off my back, get your laws out of my bedroom, and that kind of argument. So Paul is wanting to respond to that. Now, what Paul meant by all things are lawful for me, and what the New Testament means by that, is that it's typically that kind of phrase, that all things are lawful for me, would be with respect to things like dietary regulation. You have that account in Mark, for example, where Mark comments, and by this Jesus is declaring all things clean. And that was with respect to dietary kinds of issues. All things are lawful in the sense that anything that God has created, anything that God has made, is made to be enjoyed and made to be to participate in and give God thanks for it. That's how he puts it. That's how Paul puts it in 1 Timothy. He's writing to 1 Timothy. And Paul teaches that. And he says, yeah, that's true. There's a very important truth there. There's a sense in which all things are lawful for me. That's true. But not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. And the point he's wanting to make here is there's a sense in which all things are lawful for me, and that even applies to sexuality. And he's not going to deny that and say, no, that's not true. He wants to say, yeah, that's true. All things are lawful for me. Sexuality is lawful. Sex is lawful. Sexual intimacy is lawful. That's true. But that's not the whole truth. There's more that needs to be talked about. There's more that needs to be considered. Not all things are profitable. That is, not all the ways in which I can practice sexuality are profitable. And even though all things are lawful for me, I will not be mastered by anything. If my sexuality masters me instead of me mastering my sexuality, then there's something desperately wrong. So that's how he's starting the section here. I think the way it starts off, I think, because in the dietary regulations where you actually have laws against eating ossifrages and other unkosher, unclean things. I can't remember what them things are. Animals or not. Yeah, pork. Okay, shellfish and pork and stuff. You don't eat that because that's not kosher. It's actually unlawful to eat those things. It's against the law. Yeah. Now, I think in this context, it's getting transported out of a dietary context into the area of sexuality. And so for it to be against the law would mean that it's somehow prohibited by godliness, by righteousness prohibits this. Now, you can see Paul's dilemma, and you can see why he's approaching it the way that he is. I mean, if someone is just going to ask the question, well, look, Paul, is sex against the law or not? And how are you going to answer that? Because sexuality is not the kind of thing that is either against the law or not. It's not a question of sex being unlawful. It's a question of what you do with sex that's unlawful. So on the one hand, he's not going to say, no, sex is unrighteous. But on the other hand, he's not going to just say, yeah, sex, whatever manifestation is righteous. He's caught. He has to equivocate. There's a sense in which it's righteous. There's a sense in which it's not righteous. We've got to talk about that for now. Yeah, because I think he has in the background that the simplistic thinking of the people he's opposing is just that there's this black and white kind of thing. Either sex is a human, natural, God-given thing that's clean and appropriate, in which case to go see the harlot is just fine. And that's the line of reasoning that he's encountering. So to that line of reasoning, he has to say, well, it's not like I'm not going to deny that sex is created by God and is appropriate and is kosher. It's a gift from God to be enjoyed. That's all true, but it doesn't follow that you can go see the harlot, what this whole passage is about. I don't think that's their reasoning. I think they are reasoning by analogy to dietary laws. Notice what he goes on to say, and I think this will answer your question if we go on to the next. Yeah, food for the stomach, yeah. And I think here he's repeating their argument. Food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food. That's their slogan. I think what they're trying to say is, look, food, a desire for food, a hunger for food, it's just natural. It's just part of being a human being. You need to eat, you eat. By analogy then, and I think that's where they're trying to make the analogy. And granted, Moses said, you can eat this and you can't eat that. There's kosher and there's not kosher. Kind of putting limits on a very normal, natural human impulse and instinct and desire. But we saw how Jesus came along and said, oh, well, that was just kind of artificial. That there were other reasons behind that. Really, from where God sits, if he made it and it's edible, fine, you can eat it. There's nothing immoral about that. By analogy, they're saying, hey, sex is the same thing. Sex is just this normal, natural physical function, a physical reality. And if you have an impulse to have sex, then to fulfill that impulse, there shouldn't be anything wrong about it. Any constraints we would put on that, just like the dietary regulations, are just artificial constraints imposed from the outside. They're not, there's nothing intrinsically. Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, I mean, you can see how someone, and that's certainly the predominant, view today. Actually, we've gone a step beyond that today. But so the slogan is, food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food. Now, what Paul is going to say is, but there is no analogy between eating and sex. You have made a mistake to think that those are analogous. And here's how he makes that point. True, food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food, but God will do away with both of them. That is, whether I eat shellfish or pork or beef or lentils or whatever, is of really ultimately no eternal consequence. Food is food. It feeds my body, but there's going to come a day where I won't need food because I won't have this body, and what I ate back then and what body I had back then will have no lasting eternal significance and no lasting consequence. They are only a provision, a reality for the present age, and it's passing away with the present age, and there's no eternal significance to what's happening there. But the same is not true, he says, of sexuality. Now, stay with me here, because it's not like he's not saying sexuality will continue into the next age. That's not what he's saying. But he's saying how I conduct myself sexually now has eternal implications, has eternal consequences, in a way that what I eat now does not. Food is for the stomach is for food, but God will do away with both of them. Yet the body, okay, now the argument would go, food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food. Similarly, sex is for the body and the body is for sex. That's how the people he's opposing want to draw the analogy. And Paul is breaking the analogy and saying, no, that's not right. The body isn't for sex. The body is for the Lord. And sex is not for the body. The Lord is for the body. So he substitutes where they want to put sex, he puts the Lord. What you don't understand is that the body is actually the body that God has given us, particularly, and I think he's using body here as kind of a metonymy for my sexuality, actually. My sexuality is not for sex. My sexuality is for the Lord, and what he means by that is my sexuality is something that God has given me, I'm funny to call it a resource, I don't know what to call it, an attribute of my being that God has given me, a gift that he has given me that has a purpose. And it's in his purpose, and his intent, is that I manage my sexuality, that I invest my sexuality in such a way that I will glorify God. That's why he gave it to me. So it misses the whole point of my sexuality to say sexuality is for sex, because sexuality is not for sex. Sexuality is for glorifying God. And that's true in a significant way that is not true for food. You can't really say that about food in the same way that you can say that about sexuality. And therefore, Paul says, the analogy doesn't follow. You're missing the whole point. Now, God has not only raised the Lord, but will also raise us up to his power. What he's getting back is this eternal versus temporal kind of thing there. My personal identity is going to transcend this present age. My food, my stomach and the food that I put in it is not going to transcend this present age, but myself is, my personal identity. And what I'm going to argue, Paul is arguing, or Paul is assuming, is that he sees a very, very important link between my sexuality and my personal identity that links the two together in a way that food and stomach, I'm not identified by what I eat in the same way that I'm identified with my body and sexuality. That hopefully that'll become clearer as the argument goes on. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Now, members, when he talks about members, my body is made up of many members, he says in 1 Corinthians. There's hands, there's elbows, there's forearms, head, ears, mouth, nose. Those are members. That's what he means by members. Do you know that your bodies are members of Christ? That is, my members, every inch of my body belongs to him. There's a sense in which he possesses my body. That sounds weird. That's not what I meant. He owns. There we go. He owns my body. He has mastery over my body. He has authority and rights over my body. My body is to have done with it what he, my master, wants done with it. That's what he's arguing. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take away the members that belong to Christ and make them members that belong to a harlot? I'm paraphrasing a little bit. No, that doesn't make sense. Or do you not know that the one who joins himself, that is sexually, the one who joins himself sexually with a harlot is one body with her? Don't you realize that? Don't you understand that? For the scripture says the two will become one flesh. And he goes back to that Genesis passage that we looked at last week, and he says on the basis and on the authority of that Genesis passage, as he understands it, he says that ought to have told us that when you join yourself to a harlot, you are making your members her. You are giving yourself to her. She owns you in a way now. And he's saying, that's really weird. It's really weird that you would take your members that belong to Christ so that your bodies can be used to accomplish his purposes and give them to a harlot to accomplish her purposes. And what's assumed here is the incompatibility of those purposes. What God would want accomplished by his glorification through your body and what the harlot wants accomplished are radically opposed to each other. They're completely different things. And Paul is just trying to dramatize the incongruity of this thing. Now, I don't think so, because I thought about that, but I think it's important that he's talking about being joined to the harlot. See, I don't think he would make this argument if it were one's wife. Right, no, yeah. But I think his rationale there is different. I don't think that this is his rationale for that. Because this argument, I think, if I understand what he's saying, he couldn't argue, or don't you know that when one joins himself to his wife, he becomes one flesh with her, for he says the two shall become one flesh. And therefore, the rhetorical question, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Members of Christ, shall I take away the members of Christ and make them members of my wife? See, he wouldn't find that at all incongruous, I don't think. It's the fact that the harlot has purposes that are run at cross purposes to the purposes of God that makes this incongruous. Well, both. Yeah, I mean both. Yeah. That what one is doing in giving themselves to a harlot is not committing themselves to that woman for life in a moral commitment. And to do that is unloving. It's a perversion of the created order. I mean, there's all these things that are at cross purposes with what God intends. And so what Paul is saying is, can't you see the incongruity of that? You are giving yourselves to someone in a context, in a relationship, where the purposes for that relationship do nothing to accomplish the purposes of God for sexuality. And for that reason, you are giving yourself to something that is contrary and opposed to the God who owns your body, to the purposes of the God who owns your body. I'm going to struggle here to articulate this because I haven't taught this before and this is new and I'm just trying to formulate this in my own head. So your questions will help me. The point, though, behind his argument, what's assumed in his argument, and the point that I want to bring out for my purposes, is he quotes this passage, the two will become one flesh, to establish his point from Scripture that by being sexually joined to a harlot, you are giving your members to her. Now, what's significant about that, I think, is that if I'm right about how to take Genesis, the two will become one flesh is not talking about sexual intercourse. It's talking about marriage. It's talking about two people joining their lives into one life experience. And it's fundamentally a kind of moral commitment that you make to each other. And that's what I think Genesis is talking about. And yet Paul sees this commitment that is made between a man and a woman in marriage as somehow supporting his view that in sexual intercourse, you are giving yourself to the other person. Well, one of two things is going on here. Either I'm wrong about Genesis, which is a real possibility. Either I'm wrong in the way I'm taking Genesis, or, and this is what I never like to think I'm wrong, so I prefer this one, that what Paul is assuming, a hidden assumption here, is that what you find in the Genesis account about the two becoming one flesh as being the distinctive characteristic of marriage, that sexuality promotes and dramatizes and expresses and symbolizes that. And that's what I argued last week, is the nature of sexual intimacy. The nature of sexual intimacy is that it's designed by God. The psychology of sexual intimacy, as God created it, is designed by God to dramatize, express, highlight this commitment that marriage is supposed to be. When I am sexually intimate with my wife, I am saying to her, I'm yours. I'm saying to her that the deepest and most profound thing that I can give you of myself, I mean, the thing that I can give you that is an apt expression to you that I am giving you myself is to sexually give my body to you. I can't do any better than that. What I'm saying by that then is that if I give you my body, it's a pledge that I will give you everything. Everything that is mine is yours. The sense being, now if that's what Paul, that's what I'm assuming, and that's what I'm assuming Paul is assuming in building this argument and saying in constructing the argument the way he's constructing it. To make that a little bit more intuitive, what I'm getting at is that psychology that we have, that you touch me, you touch my body, you touch me. You can't get more intimate with me than with my body. Now, morally, that's not true. And emotionally, that's not true. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it's possible to give your body to someone and be very closed off from them, to not be intimate with them at all in every other area of your life. I mean, that happens all the time. And it's also possible to be intimate with someone at some level and not be sexually intimate with them. That's true as well. There is no more unapproachable part of me, in principle, unapproachable part of me than my body. I mean, I'm wired, my psychology is such that I don't just go around giving my body to anybody, anywhere, anytime. I would go around spilling my guts to anybody, anywhere, anytime if unrighteousness, fear, cowardice, and things didn't prevent me. But remove the obstacle that we have to being intimate with one another and sharing deeply from one another's soul, I don't have any sense in me that it would be inappropriate for me to do so, that I would be somehow being immodest, that I would be somehow being inappropriate to share with you my weaknesses, my sins, my vulnerabilities, whatever. I may not want to do that because I may not want you to be close to me, but I'm not against it in principle. I have no principled reason to keep you out of my life in that way. But everything in me sees it as inappropriate for you to be physically intimate with me. That's what I'm arguing is the very radically different psychology of those things. And therefore, it's that different psychology, it's that unique psychology about my body that makes it the appropriate thing to give only to my spouse. Because if only you have intimate sexual knowledge of me, then you become special and unique in my life, which is exactly what the marriage relationship is supposed to be, a unique and special relationship. I sort of said that already last week. Whether we're talking about a kind of emotional adultery, which I think can happen, or emotional fornication, or physical fornication, in every case, I am well, at the emotional level, what I'm doing is I'm becoming loyal to a person with a greater loyalty than I am giving to my family, to my spouse. And whenever that happens, it's not so much a question of how much I reveal. That's not really the problem, because I could reveal myself to someone who's not my spouse very, very deeply and very openly without it involving and without it being a shift of my loyalty. It's when it becomes a shift of one's loyalty that it becomes morally inappropriate. Now, the thing, it seems that at an intuitive level, these are a lot easier to identify than it is to analyze them, which is a serious thing. The test that I would always apply to things like this is, if my wife were to walk in and see what's going on here, would she rightfully feel jealous? If so, then I'm being inappropriate. Whatever is going on, however analyzed, I don't know how to analyze it, all I know is it's wrong. Whatever it is that's going on, whatever it is that I'm doing, it's not right. I ought to be able to welcome my wife right along with me into the relationship in the fullness of the dynamic that's going on and not be a problem. And if I can't, then there's something inappropriate. But it's very difficult to analyze. I don't know how to do that. Yeah, this is crucial to my whole theory, is that there's what I call a kind of sexual giving of yourself. And that can happen at a physical level, but it can also happen at a verbal level, an emotional level. It's just this thing in human experience, a sexual giving of myself. And that we need to keep closed off and reserved only for ourselves. So if that involves certain emotions or certain secrets, certain things I'm thinking, whatever, then yeah, it would be inappropriate to share those because it becomes sexual. Certainly in a broad sense of sexual, it becomes sexual. I'll try to flesh that out a little bit more. But yeah, I'm sure intent and motive are involved. I'm not sure it's only motive or only intent. I'm not sure that I'm really capable of analyzing. All I can hope to do is try to give you by example a feel for what I'm talking about. I've never successfully analyzed it. I think it's more than motive and more than intent, but it includes that. Although sometimes the motive and intent can actually not be conscious to us and still nevertheless be appropriate. I had an experience when I was in college. I was hitchhiking from Salem to Northern California, and I got picked up by, I don't know what they were. If they weren't weathermen, the terrorist bombers, they were some weathermen wannabes. I think they were probably running drugs, maybe weapons, but they had the station wagon with this mattress in the back and then the front seat. There was two women and a man, and they threw me back on the mattress, and I got to drive this mattress down to California. Well, I fell asleep, and then I woke up at some point, and one of the women was asleep. The other woman was talking to them. Man. And I just, kind of in a half sleep, I overheard this conversation. And the conversation was basically about this woman's practice of making money. She was basically a prostitute to make money for the revolution. And they proceeded to talk about her sexuality and her sexual practices. What did she like? What didn't she like? What turned her on? What didn't turn her on? And then eventually they stopped the car, put me up in the front seat, the other woman drove, and they received the practice, what they had been talking about. My point is that their sexual interaction had happened long before they changed places with me. I mean, it was very clear that what was going on was basically sexually giving themselves to one another, but just doing it with words at that point. So, and it was clear to me, and I wasn't even part of it. I mean, it was clear to me that what was going on. I was embarrassed. Now, on the other hand, it's not that I couldn't get up here in a class on sexuality and say some of the same things. That's what's so difficult to analyze this thing. So I could be very graphic. I could talk about anatomy, and I can talk about orgasm, I can talk about the mechanics of orgasm, all kinds of things, and not be giving myself to you sexually. And how you draw the line, how you know the difference, or I should say how you analyze the difference, is very difficult. Knowing the difference doesn't seem all that difficult to me at all in reality and in practice. Our kids, in growing up, in the schools now, they do these little things to teach about sexual abuse or prepare kids. They try to warn them, try to prepare them to report sexual abuse. And I can't remember what they have these words they use. Good touch, bad touch. Yeah. And basically what they're saying is there's good touch and there's bad touch. And if there's any bad touching going on, you're right. Bad touch is bad touch. Your intuitions are right about that, and you should tell them to stop. If it doesn't stop, maybe you should
tell somebody what they're saying is, we may not be able to define the difference between a sexual touch and a non-sexual touch, but you know it. You know the difference. And I think that's basically true. I mean, that our psyche is built to respond to it. Our psyche is built to respond to it differently than anything else that's happening in our lives. And we know the difference intuitively, even if we can't analyze it and define it. And that's sort of what I'm saying as well. But I wonder if we lived in a different society, whether they would have the same difficulty. I think what Paul is arguing for and against here is just, we have an extreme case of what, in our society, of what he's arguing against here, in that the notion that sexuality is anything more than just a physical act just seems to be completely forgotten, completely ignored in any sexual theory, in any popular attitudes about sexual ethics. That's completely and totally lost in the human. And so you have no social, cultural support for someone just saying something to you being inappropriate, because there's nothing in our society that would encourage you to think along those lines. Well, okay, yeah, that's true. But that's part of the schizophrenia of our society. Because, I mean, I'll never be able to put that together. That the modern heightened awareness of sexual abuse on the one hand, and then over here, if anything goes, roll your own sexuality on the other hand, just doesn't make any. And how you try to put those together, I don't know. Which is a good prelude to what his next comment. Because he's making exactly that point. Yeah. The 17, but the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with him, which I won't, that's just all part of his argument about the incongruity of being joined to the harlot rather than the Lord. But the next one, flee immorality. Every sin that a man commits is outside the body. My translation has every other, but I don't think that's what he means. I think he means everything. Every sin that a man commits is outside the body. It's extrinsic to the body. I think what he means is a sin against God, a sin against my brother or sister, a sin against my neighbor. That every sin involves some kind of transgression of something out there. Some sins are not only a transgression of God, not only a transgression of something out there, but are also a transgression, he says, against one's own body. I don't think only immorality is that, but that's what he's talking about. So he says, but the immoral man sins against his own body. Now, what does he mean by that? I think what he means by that, he's already working with the assumption that there's this important connection between my body and myself. So to sin against your body is to sin against yourself. And the kind of sin against yourself that it is, I think, is this. What he has in mind is, God created me to be a particular kind of being. God created me to be animal-like in some respect. I get hungry. I have sexual desires. I get sleepy. I mean, I have urges that are born of my physicality. That's true. On the one hand, I am that. But on the other hand, I'm more than that also. I'm a creature that God intended from the very beginning to be noble, to have dignity, to have honor. And the honor and the dignity is going to come from my godlikeness. And the way that godlikeness would manifest itself in the context of being a physical being, in the context of my physicality, would be if my reason and moral judgment were to rule over any of the other urges that come from my physicality. Now, that's a commonplace notion in the ancient world. I mean, not just Christianity recognized that. You can get that in Plato. You can get that in Aristotle. That's the cornerstone of their ethic, is self-control, autokrasia, power over oneself. And these are rank pagans who knew that. We are sub-pagan these days. We're not only post-Christian, we're sub-pagan. And what he's arguing is that we are actually transgressing our own being when we commit immorality, fornication. Sexual sins are a transgression of my very creative nature itself. They're a transgression of my own sexuality. I'm sinning against it. I'm not just hurting someone else. I'm sinning against me. The whole notion of victimless crime, which is part of what you're talking about, is just weird from a Christian perspective. Now, I'm not talking about the politics of it. I mean, I don't know what you should and should not make criminal offense and all that. I'm not worried about that. I'm only concerned about the immorality of it. The notion, I don't know if we should pass a law against it, but we've got to understand that it's inappropriate to spend my life staring at a white wall and dueling. Just to take an absurd example. I mean, wouldn't you find that pathetic? If someone just decided, what I'm going to do is I'm going to sit on a stool and stare at a white wall for the rest of my life and do it. I mean, we would think that was just absolutely grotesque. That someone, what the Bible calls dissipation, the fact that you would waste your life, that like spilling water on the ground, you would take your life and just throw it away like that. You were made to be a dignified, noble, respectable, honorable creature who manifested the glory of God, and you're going to drool at a wall? Well, That's an absurd example, but that's the kind of thing that he's talking about here. My sexuality was given to me to be able to be a tool to use in expressing an incredibly noble moral commitment that I make to another human being of the opposite sex. That's what it was given to me for. And in doing that, it becomes part of manifesting the glory of God. But to take that sexuality instead and act like a dog, act like a beast who simply has urges and acts on urges is dehumanizing. It's literally dehumanizing. So to make those choices, Paul is saying, is to be self-dehumanizing, self-brutalizing. You are transgressing your very own being, your very own self. You're taking the creature that God made you and smashing it, reducing it to being beast-like in your orientation. Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think there are other sins. Gluttony, for example, would be similar to that. Any time where we simply follow urges, I think he would say the same thing. But cruelty to another person or pride, for example, are sinful, but they're not really transgressing my creatureliness, not exactly in the same way, anyway. Not in a way that transgresses the structure of my creativeness. Well, if sin is transgressing something, what the immoral man is doing is he's transgressing his own physicality. He's violating his own physicality, abusing his own physicality. He's using his physicality in a way that it was not for which it was not intended. God made us physical beings, and there's nothing inappropriate about that. There's nothing wrong with that. Sex is not dirty. It's not unclean or disgusting or yucky or anything like that. It's wonderful. But it's only wonderful if the way in which I use my sexuality transcends my physicality and gets taken up into my rationality and morality. If it becomes a part of my moral commitment to another human being instead of being merely a physical urge that I follow. To make it just a physical urge that I follow, Paul says, is to abuse it, is to violate it, is to transgress it. Well, both are wrong. Sorry, I'm not understanding myself. It's stressing one over the other, so I'm not sure I'm understanding your question or your problem. Oh, okay. I don't think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying sinning against other people. That's bad. But boy, if you also sin against, I don't think that's what he's doing. That's part of where I don't fully understand this passage, and so I'm not sure I'm keen enough to answer that. I'm just more inclined to think that what he's dealing with are people who are thinking along the lines, "Hey, food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food. We're just physical creatures." We're just physical beings. Physical beings have to eat. How can there possibly be anything wrong with that? That's the mindset that he's up against. So when he says every sin that a man commits is outside the body, but what you have to understand about sexuality is to employ your sexuality in the way that you are by going to see the harlot, what you have to understand is you're transgressing your own sexuality, something that's not true of eating. You're not transgressing your God's created design by eating when you're hungry. That's what it's intended to be like. Yeah, if you're married, this is not, you're not sinning. No, yeah, that's very important to see that. This is only a misapplication of your sexuality, not sexuality as a downright destructive. Well, it may be that that's what he has in mind. I don't know for sure whether he has it in mind or not. I think that it's true. I think, for example, there's a kind of self-destructiveness about sexual immorality that's not true of other sins. They don't violate my own psyche in quite the same kind of way. It's interesting in reading Kant, the philosopher Immanuel Kant, in his Ethics, he has a whole section of what he calls self-abuse. And self-abuse was a euphemism back in those days for masturbation. But, and so I don't think this is unique to Kant, but he kind of picks up on the cultural current at the time. But it's really interesting that masturbation would be considered self-abuse by them. But I think they've tapped into something, by calling it that, they've tapped into something very, very, very true. I mean, the question that any book that even deals with the subject of masturbation, and a lot of them don't, but any book that even deals with the subject of masturbation, the question they ask is, or the biggest problem they see with masturbation is, the guilt that comes from it, the guilt that follows. Why do I feel so guilty when I practice masturbation? And good old modern thinkers, we try to talk them out of their guilt. That's obviously the solution to that, is to somehow tell them, there's one book that I read that calls masturbation the greatest gift that God gave us. I mean, this is an evangelical writer. This is no... Now, it seems to me that we should take a good hard look at our experience and say, wait a minute, if this is the greatest gift that God gave us, then why do we struggle so much with guilt over this thing? This is not just, even after talking ourselves out of it being wrong, we still struggle with it. So why does it have its claws in it, this guilt have its claws in it so deeply? Could it be that there really is guilt here at some point? And I would argue that there is, and it's a particularly brutalizing kind of guilt, because in effect what I'm doing when I masturbate is that I'm reducing myself to an animal operating on animal impulses, or animal urges, responding to animal urges, and I'm not conducting myself with the dignity and the nobility of a creature who can master his passion, who can control his passion. And I feel the weight of that. The impact of that is what I interpret as guilt, which isn't really guilt so much, because we're guilty about a lot of things, but we don't feel the same way toward it. It's not so much guilt as it is self-brutalization is what it is. I have actually sinned against myself. I have actually treated myself like something other than what God created me to be. I have victimized myself. And we feel our self-victimization, and that's what we call guilt, I think. I think that's at least congruent with what he's saying here, if he doesn't even have that in mind. Everything I've read, I've gone back and forth, and I've tried to convince myself by arguments and reading and everything that masturbation is not sinful. I've tried to convince myself that that's true, and I just can't do it. One, commonsensically, it just seems to me that it is taking the means to some end and making it an end in itself, which I think is fundamentally wrong, fundamentally immoral. So just logically, I am stuck that I can't, it doesn't seem to me that sexuality is given to us